I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're back with The Takeaway. The 2020 Summer Olympics, scheduled to take place in Tokyo, Japan, have been postponed due to the global coronavirus pandemic. This postponement may seem like an obvious move since all other major sporting events are also on hiatus, but the International Olympic Committee, or the IOC, was the last holdout, with their decision coming after countries like Canada and Australia publicly stated they would not be sending their athletes to participate in the Games. The IOC has been plagued by scandals and corruption over recent years, and our next guests have thoughts about what the IOC's handling of the coronavirus pandemic tells us about the organization's failures and its future. Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player. He writes about the Olympics, and he's a professor of politics and government at Pacific University in Oregon. And Amira Rose Davis is assistant professor of history and African American studies at Penn State University and co-host of the feminist sports podcast, Burn It All Down. I asked Amira for her take on how the IOC handled the coronavirus outbreak as soon as it began.
Basically, they just acted as slowly as humanly possible. They were really insistent on still having the games, even as sports around the world were canceling, as things were shutting down and people were really kind of seeing what this pandemic was doing and the issues that could arise. The IOC was still really insistent on the games going on. And what's more, they were using a rhetoric to kind of foster this false sense of the power of the Olympics, alleging that the peace and solidarity, which is the kind of way they describe what they do, of the Olympic Games were going to heal the world. One IOC official even said the flames of the Olympic torch will extinguish the virus. And so you could see them kind of hanging to this romantic notion of what they believe the Olympic Games to be, or what they were selling the Olympic Games as, and completely ignoring everybody's kind of cries over the difficulty of actually staging the games this summer in July.
Right, right. So then what happened? They eventually did decide to postpone the games. Why?
Well, in part because not only did it just become very clear that this was not going to be resolved by July, and having, even if Japan was kind of settling down with the pandemic, having an international community dump into that area was not going to be sustainable. And they were like refusing to even consider not having it with fans. So it was just going to be completely terrible. But on top of that, what really forced them into that is a lot of federations started very publicly saying, we're not going to send athletes. The Canadian group was really vocal, and first Australia joined them, and they said, it doesn't matter what you decide to do, we're not putting our athletes in danger. And then individual places in the United States, like the swimmers, were like, we can't train, we can't go to pools. So, you know, qualifying rounds have been canceled. Like, we cannot possibly do this. And I think behind the scenes, they started to feel some pressure from their sponsors, which we know is really what makes the IOC do much of anything, is when you follow the money.
Getting to that, how is that how they decided on the new timing, Amira? How did they figure that all out in terms of making it next July, right? Next July 2021?
Yeah, certainly cancellation was completely off the table. That would have been a lot of money that they would have had let go. And the longer they tried to push it, the more they risked a lot of that kind of bottom line. And so you saw that there was this desire to just kind of remount the games next year, even though on its face, while it seems fairly simple, it's very complicated to just postpone a game a year. And so just recently, they announced that the games are slated to start on July 23rd of 2021 and run until August 8th of that same year. And that was recently announced, and that they hope will give them some time to move the entire infrastructure of the games, to deal with venue conflicts, to deal with the ticket issues, and hopefully, in their eyes, just remount the same games next year at the time. But I think there's a lot of logistics that are going to have to be worked out, and this is far from settled, even if they can, you know, proudly announce the fact that they have these dates scheduled now.
Jules, what do you think about how the IOC handled this when it comes to the athletes involved?
Right. Well, first of all, postponement, as Amira said, would never have happened were it not for the bold leadership of athletes, sports organizations, and national Olympic committees like Canada, Australia, Germany, and Portugal. While the International Olympic Committee and Tokyo organizers were dithering, promising that the games needed to go on, athletes stepped up into the leadership vacuum and they demanded that the games be postponed. I mean, someone had to step up and face epidemiological reality. And the fact that it was athletes leading the way, I thought was really impressive. You know, I view all this as tantamount to sort of a radiologist injecting contrast dye into a body to more clearly see the organs and tissues and bones. Similarly, the way that the International Olympic Committee and the Tokyo organizers mishandled this postponement allows us to see in pretty sharp contrast the imperfections that plague the Olympic body. For example, the questionable nature of their IOC's athletes first slogan, as well as the ornamental relationships that the IOC holds with groups like the World Health Organization and the United Nations. And so what happened with Olympic boxing, I think, captures both of these dynamics at once and gives us a real window on what the International Olympic Committee truly thinks about athletes at the end of the day. So after the International Boxing Federation was absolutely ravaged by corruption, the International Olympic Committee took over managing its qualification events and then went on to allow a qualifier to take place in mid-March, despite the fact that it was obvious then that coronavirus was a serious problem. In fact, on March 11th, the World Health Organization declared coronavirus a pandemic. 3 days later, on March 14th, the Olympic boxing qualifying events kicked off in London before being called off only a few days later. You know, at least six people have said that they had contracted COVID-19 while participating in that event. And, you know, that's unconscionable. This so-called leadership from the International Olympic Committee has put athletes in danger while at the same time ignoring the World Health Organization, a group the IOC supposedly works with closely. And you've seen frustration from athletes left and right. During this whole kerfuffle, Thomas Bach, the president of the International Olympic Committee, told athletes to just keep your eye on the prize and just keep training for the Olympics as if they were happening this summer. And athletes shot back where and how. I mean, here in the United States, both of the Olympic training centers were closed in Lake Placid and Colorado Springs, shutting off the opportunity for athletes to train. Same for many of the colleges and universities where athletes who are aspiring for the Olympics are training. And so I think this whole episode has really cast into doubt the International Olympic Committee's commitment to athletes first, as they'll often tell us.
Jules, this is not the first issue regarding the IOC in recent history. Can you catch us up on the IOC's troubles of late?
Oh, sure. I mean, the International Olympic Committee is a privileged sliver of the global 1%. There's 100 members. 10 of them are dukes, barons, princesses. They didn't allow women into the group as members until 1981. You heard me right, 1981. I mean, wow. This is not a proto-feminist organization, and they have loads of internal problems. You know, for them, the postponement episode kind of conveniently deflects from deeper issues with the Olympics, such as overspending, the militarization of the public sphere that inevitably comes with the Olympics, displacement and gentrification of everyday working people. All this discussion around postponement has meant we are actually not talking about some of those ingrained features of the Olympics. You know, look at Tokyo. The fact that the Tokyo 2020 organizers are now suggesting that the games will cost an additional $2.7 billion because of the delay, it should be eye-popping to everyday working people in Japan who will pay the bill through their taxes. When Tokyo signed up for the Olympics, they agreed to be on the hook for all cost overruns. And the original budget for the Olympics was $7.3 billion. They'll tell you it's $12.6 billion, but an official government audit taking place in Japan says it's more like $28 billion. So costs have basically multiplied by four. So maybe some of these issues that have been slid under the rug will now get a second airing now that we have another year before the Olympics are slated to commence.
Amira, do you think there's a way to fix some of these structural issues with the IOC in advance of the postponed Olympics in 2021?
Well, certainly. I mean, there's a lot of people on the ground who have a long history of pushing back against the IOC for the way that there's ill effects of these Olympic Games in terms of housing and militarization costs, in terms of what the games leave behind when they pack up and leave, and how that leaves local places really struggling. And so I think there's already structures in place that are existing to mount critique on the IOC, to mobilize people. And it also requires for, I think, all of us to really loosen our grip on the kind of emotional or romantic vision we have of what the Olympic Games are. It requires us to peel back the curtain and be attuned to the issues that Jules just so eloquently described, but also understand for the athletes, this has also disrupted them in serious ways, and not the superstar athletes that we might be more familiar with, but Olympic hopefuls, aspiring athletes who are now forced into figuring out how they're going to survive financially for another year. A lot of athletes, particularly women athletes, depend on these Olympic years for the bulk of their incomes, for their opportunities to get endorsement deals, to build up the structures of women's athletics. Think about the women's national soccer team that was counting on having a 1-2 punch of the World Cup into Olympic year to really sustain and bolster them as they continue to fight for pay equity. Or think of individual athletes who, you know, like Gwen Berry, who made headlines for protesting at Pan American Games. You know, she told me in conversation, she's like, I'm taking it day by day. I guess I'll have to go back to work. And so understanding all the levels that go into the Olympic Games beyond just the feel-good packages that we receive when we consume them every 4 years allows us to step into this opportunity and say, well, what can we be done? Well, one, we can continue to push individual federations to do right by their athletes, to, you know, provide adequate health care, to make sure they're overseeing stuff like sexual assault in the sport. Also continuing to push the IOC and not letting them ratchet up the budget, use this as a cover, keeping an eye on them beyond talks of postponement and really getting into the weeds of these discussions.
Amira Rose Davis is the co-host of the Burn It All Down Feminist Sports Podcast and assistant professor of history at Penn State University. And Jules Boykoff is a former professional soccer player and the author of 4 books on the Olympics, most recently No Olympians and Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We reached out to the IOC for comments, and they directed us to recent statements on media conference calls by IOC President Thomas Bach. Readouts from those calls are linked at our website, thetakeaway.org.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.